Yeah, these are things I like to talk about. The first question of motivation. The nuclear mass models, if anyone has done any course at all in nuclear physics, the very first thing you learn is the semi-empirical mass model of Weizsäcker back in 1935. If you don't know this, then you don't know anything in nuclear physics. The 30 years later, this semi-empirical mass formula essentially just involved the liquid drop ideas of the nucleus. 30 years later, 1966, Myers and Sieradesky were able to introduce shell corrections to this Weizsäcker picture. And essentially, the shell corrections were grafted on. 30 years later, this model of Myers and Sieradesky had become refined to a very high degree, and these people were able to reproduce the masses of all the nuclei that had been measured at that time with a remarkably low RMS error. So the question is, after all this, after such a successful climax, is anything left to be done? And the answer, obviously, is quite a lot. There's a considerable interest in constructing mass models, nuclear mass models, that are far more microscopic than the one developed by Myers and Sieradesky. There are two sets of reasons. The first reason is, in a sense, ideological. One would like to be able to derive all nuclear properties starting from basic nucleon-nucleon and three-nucleon forces and mass. Nuclear masses are one of the best measured properties of nuclei. Therefore, one would like a nuclear mass model that was completely microscopic. But there's a second set of reasons, which is far more practical, and this is actually our own interest, and it's namely a matter of astrophysics. There are two main astrophysical topics here that interest us and for which we need a microscopic mass model. The first is the first phenomenon is the R process of nuclear synthesis. As you probably know, all stars, right from their birth, are undergoing some kind of nuclear synthesis. This goes on throughout the lifetime of a star. But half of all the nuclei. This thing is really very sensitive. Half of all the nuclei in the universe with mass number bigger than 65 are actually synthesized in an extremely violent process at the very end, in the last few seconds, the last fraction of a second of the lifetime of a star. And this is a process that takes place in the presence of large neutron fluxes. And it's referred to as the R process. And R means rapid. And rapid here means rapid capture of neutrons on a time scale that is extremely rapid compared to beta decay. And the most likely site for such a process is in the type 2 supernovae, the gravitational collapse supernovae. Now, OK. Just to indicate schematically what happens, the red points here represent all the known nuclei, that is, nuclei whose masses have been measured. On this side, you have nuclei that are rich in protons and therefore unstable with respect to beta plus decay. On this side, you have nuclei that are neutron rich and therefore beta minus and unstable. As you go move out in this direction, this doesn't show up very well at all on this screen. As you move out in this direction, you're going to nuclei that are more and more neutron-rich. And finally, when you hit the blue line here, this represents the limit of bound nuclei. If you try to add more neutrons to these nuclei beyond this blue dotted line, it's impossible. Extra neutrons are essentially unbound. Now, the R process takes place along this green plot, which is almost invisible. That's on the hard copy, it's quite clear. You see this jagged green line here. This is the R process path. And the way in which this is determined and the significance of it is as follows. In the presence of a large neutron flux, seed nuclei, this is not good. Seed nuclei here, typically iron 56, will capture neutrons, and before the nucleus has time to beta decay, it will capture another neutron. And if the temperature was zero, it would be carried right out to the so-called neutron drip line. In fact, because the finite temperature, neutrons will start to boil off before the drip line is reached, and an equilibrium will be set up in which neutrons are being boiled off as fast as neutrons are being captured. This will happen when the neutron separation energy of the nucleus in question is equal, roughly speaking, to the Boltzmann energy for the corresponding temperature. Now, let's look up here. This is simpler now. A nucleus is going to sit here. It'll move out from the known region, sit on this line here, and after a certain time, beta decay will occur. When the beta decay occurs, the nucleus moves up here, and then it can now capture more neutrons. And so it will move out to the in the direction of the drip line again. And so you'll have a zigzag process like this going on. At some undetermined point up here, the situation becomes quite unstable, and the nucleus will disintegrate simply through neutron-induced fission. So now you have two large fission fragments which get cycled back into the beginning of the process. And I need two of these things. And the whole process will continue. There'll be a cycling along this green line will continue as long as the intense neutron flux is maintained. But after a few seconds, that flux will be shut off, and then the nuclei on this green path will decay back towards the region of beta stability. And those are the R-process nuclei that you observe in nature. It's interesting enough, all nuclei, all the elements heavier than bismuth can only be made through the R process. In other words, radium, uranium, all those elements are formed almost as an afterthought in the last second or so of a star after several hundred million years of existence. Now, the position of the R process path is determined by the neutron separation energies. It's a question of the neutron separation energy has to be equal to the Boltzmann energy at this point. And of course, the neutron separation energy depends on masses. The rate of beta decay along this line will depend, among other things, on the Q betas, that is, the energy available for beta decay. And that, too, depends on the masses. So this is why the R process does depend critically on nuclear masses. And it will also depend critically on fission barriers, since the fission barriers determine where this green dotted line, which you can't see, where it comes to an end. So we need reliable mass models to extrapolate from the data out to the neutron drift line. And for reliability, the mass model must not only fit the data, but be as theoretically sound as possible. And we interpret this to mean that the model must be as microscopic as possible. And at the present time, the best you can do is the Hartree-Fock-Bogle-U-Boat method using Skirm forces. That's the first astrophysical application. The second astrophysical application is to the determination of the composition of the crust of neutron stars. There are two parts to the crust. I should have practiced this. The outer crust, on the outermost part of the surface, you'll have an ordinary nickel-62 nucleus. This is the most stable nucleus that exists. But as you move in, the electron density. Remember, the star is electrically neutral everywhere, so all the nuclei are neutralized. But the electrons form a more or less homogeneous gas as soon as you get a few meters below the surface. As the electron density rises, electrons, it becomes energetically favorable for electrons to be captured. So as we move down, we're going to find more and more nuclei that are more and more neutron-rich, until finally you reach the drip line, and at still higher densities, neutrons are going to start leaking out. And this is the difference between the outer crust and the inner crust. The outer crust is characterized by ordinary nuclei, some of which are quite exotic, being so highly neutron-rich. But in the next layer here, you will have neutron-proton clusters floating around in a free neutron vapor. And then, finally, the transition to the homogeneous core of the star. There, I simply summarized some of the details of the crust. And now, that's the stage. Those are the two applications that we want to consider. Here is the model, the Hartree-Fock-Bogle-U-Boat model. We limit it to a Skirm-type force, and we have the conventional form of Skirm force here, which is probably, at least a nuclear physicist, quite familiar. We also include pairing, the proton-proton and neutron-neutron pairing. And then in addition to that, we have to include a generalized Wigner term. This is to take account of the excess binding energy that is found for nuclei with N close to Z. I don't have time to go into this, and any people can ask me strategic questions about that. So I summarize the results of the data fits. I should say there's a tremendous amount of computation goes into these data fits, because we have to perform Hartree-Fock-Bogle-U-Boat calculations for all 2,000 measured nuclei, and each nucleus has to be calculated many, many times as one adjusts the parameters of the force. In addition to fitting the data, we also ask, impose an additional constraint. We want our mass model not only to give a good fit to the data, but we want it to be reliable for extrapolating out to neutron-rich nuclei, and in fact, out beyond the drip line to the inner crust of the of neutron stars. So we impose an additional constraint of requiring that the equation of state of we calculate the pure neutron matter correctly. And neutron matter can't be observed, but it can be calculated fairly reliably from two and three body forces. This shows what happens. The BSK, the black solid line here, is the Freeman Pandari Panda. It's the other way around. The dotted line here, which you can hardly see, is the theoretical calculation of Freeman and Pandari Panda for neutron matter. The black line is our most recent force. And you see the fit to neutron matter is extremely good. The A18 star is something else. The best parameter fit we have so far, I just showed the neutron matter performance for it, BSK13. We fit all the data with this root mean square error, and we've constructed complete mass tables for this force, going out from one drip, from the proton drip line to the neutron drip line. Now, I don't have time to discuss our results of fission barriers unless, again, someone asks me an appropriate question. Let me say a few words about the extrapolation beyond the neutron drip line. This is required for the inner crust of the neutron star. And the way we handle it is so far this has been done without shell model corrections. We use the semi-classical, the fourth order extended Thomas Fermi method, and we adopt a Wigner Seitz model. This is the Wigner Seitz model for these neutron-proton clusters which are swimming in or floating in the neutron vapor. And we can calculate the optimum cell composition, that is the optimal composition of each Wigner Seitz cell, of the Wigner Seitz cell for each density in the crust. Now, let me just summarize the results for the neutron star crust. The neutron star is supposed now to be at essentially T equals zero, that is zero temperature on a nucleus scale. It's about 0.1, 0.05 MeV, in fact. But the star was initially hot, and therefore one assumes that statistical equilibrium existed in the past. So we're essentially looking at for a unique N and Z at each density. There are two regions, the outer crust. The outer crust is simply a question of looking up the nuclear masses from the computed, from the table we've computed, and of course, we have to include the contribution of the electron gas to the total energy. Then the inner crust, we use the Wigner Seitz calculation. So here are the results. Yeah, this green is terrible. Yeah. The red line is the proton. The number of protons in each cell or in each nucleus. The green line is the neutrons. Here, we're in the we're starting in the surface of the star, nickel 62 around here. I don't understand this. As we move in, the density is increasing. The Z increases very, very slightly, N slightly faster. And then you see there are a number of discontinuous changes. And the neutron numbers are always magic. We reach here the drip line. This is the transition between the outer crust and the inner crust. Once you're in the inner crust, the number of protons doesn't change too much, but the number of neutrons in each Wigner Seitz cell increases enormously. You have cells of over 1,000 neutrons. So that is basically the highly impressionistic survey of the kind of calculations we've been doing for these last few years. And now, just to summarize, we've been able to construct nuclear mass models with the SCIRP HFB method, giving a high quality fits to the mass data and also to neutron matter. We've calculated complete mass tables from one drip line to the other, which we use for computing the R process and also for the outer crust of neutron stars. And as I've just indicated, these forces, the forces we scale forces we constructed, can now be used to extrapolate beyond the drip line to give the equation of state for the inner crust of neutron stars. Well, I say fission is problematic. I didn't even have time to discuss it. But we do have problems with fission, and it is crucial if one is going to understand the R process. So that is, I guess that's about it, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Thank you.